Good evening, everyone. Welcome to lesson number 4 of Beyond Personal Freedom. It's tonight. Tonight's topic is a very fundamental principle in Judaism and Torah. And today in the society, it's a big concept, but the Torah has a whole different approach. Torah is 3,334 years with this approach. Society is just recently, but years it wasn't like this. The meaning of freedom. Freedom. What does it mean, freedom? And this is going to make a big difference when you hire workers. Do workers have to work for you? Or could they quit midday? We're going to discuss that. And if they quit, do they still have to pay them for the full day, even though they quit midday? Also, it has going to be effect with people that steal money, and they don't. Or let's not take steal, borrow. Let's say someone borrows $100,000, and they don't have what to pay back with. They don't have money to pay back. What do you do to the person? Do you put him in jail? What do you do? And what is the Torah's approach? Because what does freedom really mean? And when we understand what freedom really means, then we could understand what an employee means, and what an employer means, and what means a debt, and what means a borrower and a lender. And that has a major application in our day-to-day life with any worker that works for us. That's an employee. I'm not saying about a contractor. That's a little different that we'll soon discuss. But an employee and an employer is a different relationship than a contractor and the one that the contractor is working for. Because really, in essence, a contractor is working for himself. Not working for you. He wants to make money. It's not it's the employee is working for the employer. It's not self. So, what is freedom? So, believe it or not, in the 1800s, there was still the concepts of, there was still the concepts of slavery. You know that, right? In the United States, in the early 1800s, and then eventually it got abolished. But there was a case. More and more states in the United States got rid of slavery. You know, they were starting slowly. So there was a case in 1857. Is it on the video? So we'll put it just on the video so we don't have to read the text inside, and then we'll discuss the legal matter about a slave that came to visit she lived in Tennessee and came to live in, I think, Massachusetts, or where did she come? Anyways, because in Tennessee you were still allowed to have slaves. In Massachusetts, not. And they wanted her to, and she wanted to be a slave because she liked her owner. They treated her well. And she had a husband. And they were married slaves. And they had children. And she wanted to be a slave. And she and the court, and they went to court. So what did the judge say? Could a person choose to be a slave if they want to be a slave? So let's see for a moment the presentation of this video.
Throughout the 17th and 18th centuries, people were brutally kidnapped from Africa and forced into slavery in the American colonies. By the mid-19th century, however, the United States was fiercely disunited over the practice of slavery. The southern states built their entire economy on the exploitation of people as slaves, whereas the northern states had abolished the practice as a contradiction to the right of every human to be free. This friction led to the Civil War of 1861. But just 4 years shy of the war, and just 8 years before slavery was permanently abolished throughout the United States, a Massachusetts court faced a slavery case with an unusual twist. The defendants were a white couple, Lewis and Laura Sweet, who lived in Nashville, Tennessee, where slavery was still legal and prevalent. During their travels, the Sweets were in the habit of taking along their black slave, a lady by the name of Betty. In 1857, the Sweets toured Canada and various northern states, but when they arrived in Lawrence, a city in the abolitionist state of Massachusetts, they ran into trouble. Local anti-slavery activists recoiled at the sight of a woman of color accompanying her white master and mistress. They demanded that the Sweets set Betty free. The couple claimed that they would not retain Betty against her will, but that Betty was not seeking her freedom. The activists then turned to Betty. They begged her to assert her rights and to refuse to return to Tennessee with the Sweets, but Betty brushed them away. One Lawrence activist, a widow named Lucy Skyler, petitioned the Boston courts to intervene. The case, referred to simply as Betty's case, was heard by Massachusetts Chief Justice Lemuel Shaw, a deep thinker with considerable influence on the development of American law. Shaw requested the party's consent to interview Betty in private. He reported,
"I proposed and had an examination of the said Betty, apart from the said Sweet and wife, and all other persons, upon which it appeared to me that she is 25 years old, intelligent, and capable of judging for herself, that she has a husband in Tennessee and other relatives, that she is much attached to Mr. and Mrs. Sweet, is very well treated by them, and desires to remain and return with them. And this desire she expressed decisively, and upon repeated inquiries. I explained to her her right to freedom and protection here, and that she could not lawfully be taken away against her will."
The judge found himself in a quandary. Under the laws of his state, slavery was illegal and wrong. On the other hand, Betty insisted that she wished to remain with her masters. Betty's freedom appeared to be pitted against her free choice. Judge Shaw opted for the free choice argument.
"It was contrary to all the principles of freedom that this or any other person should not exercise a free choice in such a matter. Betty was entirely at liberty to exercise her free choice, and no one could interfere with her without incurring a personal liability. Wherefore it was ordered and adjudged that the said Betty be at free liberty to remain with Mr. and Mrs. Sweet, or go elsewhere at her free choice, and that all persons be interdicted and forbidden to interfere with her personal liberty in this respect."
The underlying dilemma of Betty's case rings louder and lingers longer than an individual judge's decision. Should an individual be free to choose to be a slave?
What do you say? You could choose to be a slave? It's your free?
Yeah, but yeah, it's free choice, yes.
What do
you think? You can't choose something that's illegal, can't I? You can't choose, oh, I want to marry, you know, three women. You can do it without the legal, you know, without the legal.
Just like a friend, like a friend.
Right. I mean, even if you talk about rape, you cannot have a relationship with a minor. If it's against the law, it's against the law. You just, you.
But you didn't go on any law.
Yeah. No, slavery is abolished.
It's a free choice. What's slavery?
No, slavery is. So she can be on your rights. It's a different title. Like,
you pay
so
her
rules,
you pay
her
food, you pay her family,
she cannot be a slave. She's a certain, she's...
She didn't do anything wrong.
She's a maid, but she cannot be
under
the title
of
slave.
Go with mine,
or anything you have to say about this, or?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard not to look back at this from the perspective of somebody in 2022. But I have to say that even by the standards of 1857, this was a backward and wicked decision. It wasn't like Massachusetts had just eliminated slavery the year before. Slavery had already been unlawful in Massachusetts at that point for 75 years. Like Marav said, you can't consent to certain deprivations of your personal liberty. And even if you could, Betty's choice isn't free in any real sense of the word. I mean, she was brought up in slavery. Even if she were, you know, quote unquote, set free, she would probably be captured and returned to slavery like that guy in 12 Years a Slave. She couldn't get a job anywhere. No white person would employ her. Even if she got free, her husband and her children don't get free. So it's not really a free choice. I mean, by today's standards, it's not a close case. I mean, you know, the federal government banned slavery in the 13th Amendment in 1865. New York banned slavery in 1817. New Jersey banned slavery in 1866. And in addition, there, in both New Jersey and New York, there are minimum wage laws. You can't employ somebody without paying them, and you can't consent to be paid less than the minimum wage. In New York, the minimum wage in most areas is $15 an hour. In New Jersey, it's $13 an hour, and you can't contract with an employer to be paid a lower wage than that, much less to be paid nothing for the remainder of your life.
So that's, you're saying, similar, if, let's say, someone would consent to get paid less than the lower minimum wage, can't it be illegal?
No,
it's not legal, he's saying. He's saying you can't, even if you want to, he's saying the law doesn't accept it. Because why? What's the reason? Because it's...
Because certain employment rights are inalienable. You can't contract your way out of them. I mean, if you could, then employment, there wouldn't be much left of employment law, because employers usually have a greater bargaining power. So if they were free to do so, an employer could always find workers desperate enough to work for less than the minimum wage, workers desperate enough to work without being paid overtime compensation, or children willing to work in violation of the child labor laws.
What's the age of work, 16?
16.
Generally speaking, 16, but there are some exceptions, you know, summer camps and such.
Okay, the second thing is overtime. If they consent to work overtime for regular minimum wage,
no,
is that legal?
That
you can't either?
No.
So it's over time and a half?
Yeah.
Automatic.
Sorry?
Even if you consent?
Yeah, you can't contract your wage overtime. I mean, that's the case with most employment laws. You can't, an employer and employee can't contract to the contract. You know, you can't enter into a contract that makes it lawful to discriminate based on race or gender or some other protected classification.
That's interesting.
That's kind of where the concept of law really lies. Because if you, exactly what you're saying, if you have these stipulations and protocols and rules, you know, I guess many rules have exceptions, but if you don't really adhere to it, kind of like really bending the laws of why to have laws to begin with.
Yeah, I mean, the employer always has the greater bargaining power, so if you could contract out of employment laws, you can be sure that workers and employers would contract their way out of all of them. There's always somebody who's, I mean, this is my area of practice, I'm an employment lawyer, there's always somebody who's desperate enough to work for minimum wage or illegal to do so. There's always somebody, you know, for example, in the restaurant industry, you know, there are plenty of busboys who, even if they weren't, you know, they don't speak English, they don't have a lot of job prospects. If it weren't illegal for the employer to pay them less than the minimum wage, the employer could easily pay them less than the minimum wage, and they would, quote unquote, freely agree to it because they don't really have any better options.
I mean, what other places do? They pay cash, so then it's not on the books. You don't know what's going on. But if you want to put things on the books legally, you have to show that you pay at least minimum, right? That's the point, right?
Right.
Okay.
Every state has a different minimum wage. There's no such thing as there's a federal guideline, but every state still has a different minimum wage.
Oh, that's...
I'm sorry?
Yeah, I mean, there's a federal minimum wage.
There's a federal minimum wage.
What's the federal?
It's $7.25 an hour, but states are free to
right,
set higher. And a lot of them do. You know, like I said, New York is 15 in most areas. New Jersey is 13. There are some states that just pay the minimum wage.
They do $7.50?
Yeah, there are some that do.
Well, Amazon just fought a case, and they stopped working the union. They tried to unionize, and the union backed off. They had just started. They were the people that were signing wanted to be union, and all of a sudden, from nowhere, Amazon apparently won that the union is not taking over that particular location. In Vegas, there are, every hotel is unionized excepting the Victorian, I think it was, Jewish guys, because he was paying more than union. He just wanted to control his hotel. So you pay more.
Well, union is more of the rights of the employee, more than the...
No, the union is for the rights of the bosses of the union.
I understand, but officially they're protecting the employee.
Supposedly.
That's what officially is supposed to be, no?
Yeah.
Supposedly.
All right, yeah.
Yeah.
Sure.
My dear friends, very good discussion. We're going to just go into text 2 on page 106. We're going to skip text 1. Text 2, because we just heard it on the video, is what is freedom? What's the concept of freedom? Is freedom, we call it a negative liberty or a positive liberty? What does freedom really mean? When I say a negative, means freedom from, like I'm being freed from being restrained, from being abused, from being, you know, stress. So it's freedom from something. So it's more of a negative. Or is freedom liberty, freedom to? Like, I have the freedom to choose how to live my life, you know, choose what I want. What's freedom mean? Is freedom more to get off my back all the things I don't want, like, so to say? Or is freedom more about my purpose of why I'm here, my life? You get what I'm saying? So let's just read text 2.
Negative liberty is the absence of obstacles, barriers, or constraints. One has negative liberty to the extent that actions are available to one in this negative sense. Positive liberty is the possibility of acting, or the fact of acting, in such a way as to take control of one's life and realize one's fundamental purposes. The idea of distinguishing between a negative and a positive sense of the term liberty goes back at least to Kant, and was examined and defended in depth by Isaiah Berlin in the 1950s and 60s.
Okay, you can see it also on the PowerPoint, but with Betty's case, Betty was the servant of this white couple. She wanted, officially, she wanted to be a slave. Which, interesting, in the Torah, there is a law called Ahavti es Adoni. If a servant says, I like my master and I want to stay another... Because in Jewish law, it's a limb. He wants to stay a little more. So there's a whole thing. They have to pierce his ears. How dare you that you want to stay longer than you require to? It's not something you should. He says, "Well, my boss is treating me so well. How else would I want to leave? Good, great food, great lounge, great vacations. What do I want?" The Torah is not happy with it, but if you want it, I'll give it to you up to a certain time. Huh? Yeah. So the question is a freedom... So this Betty said she wants to be a slave, meaning for her, her freedom was to work for these people. She felt like that. Let's say she did. Let's say she did feel like that. So if you look at freedom as liberty, negative liberty, meaning I'm freed from negative, for her it wasn't negative. For her it was great. This is her world. She felt she was in heaven. But if you look at freedom, that it's positive, it's the choice that you could live and make a choice in life and have a purpose in life, we don't know for sure. Maybe she had the wrong purpose. Maybe she thought this is what her purpose is. But maybe there's a higher purpose. It's not just working for someone. Maybe it's working for God, you know. So this is a whole debate. So in Judaism, Freedom is a different perspective totally. It has nothing to do with negative, like getting rid of the, I don't want this, and nothing to do with the positive. It's a total different concept, yeah? You have a question? Oh. So let's go to text 3, because this is where I want to stress, and then we'll get to the employee, employer, you know, the rights.
No person is free except for those who occupy themselves with someone.
The Torah says a very strange thing. It's a funny law, but it says in the Torah that you're not free unless you occupy yourself with Torah. Now, it sounds a little strange. I'll tell you why. There's one more line to this. Is occupy yourself with Torah and follow the mitzvahs, you know, follow the Torah laws. Because a lot of people tell you these words. I find Torah very restrictive. I could only eat this kind of food. I could only work on these days of the week. There's a lot of, the Torah has a lot of laws that seem to make it very restrictive and very limited. I could only marry like this. I could only, there's so many hundreds of laws in the Torah and Shabbos and... But he says here that if you want to be a free person, freedom is only if you occupy yourself with Torah and do the mitzvahs. Why? There's something, you know, I want to be free and I want to do what I want, not what Torah tells me to want. You know what I mean? So we'll get to this concept that will blow us away. What Torah considers freedom is a whole different perspective. Now, when God took us out of Egypt, we were slaves in Egypt for 210 years. You know what he said? I'm taking you out of Egypt. I'm taking you out of slavery. But guess what? You're not free. You're my slaves now. So it seems to be that we're still slaves. Meaning, we were slaves in Egypt to Paro. And God says, I'm taking you out of Paro, but guess what? Avadai him, you're my slaves now. You gotta listen to me. The Jew says, What kind of deal is this? If you're taking me out free, let me do what I want. I have to be your servant. Look what he says in text 4 and 5. Read.
The children of Israel belong to me as servants. They are my servants whom I brought out of Egypt. I am your God. The children of Israel belong to me as servants. But then this verse God is saying, they are my servants, not servants to other servants.
So the question is that freedom? Is that what freedom is all about? That I take you out of being slaves to Egypt and now you're slaves to God, so I'm still a slave. What changed? And guess what? I think it's worse. When I was with Paro, I could eat at least non-kosher at least 3 times a day. With God, I can't. God, what are you doing to me? You know what? I'd rather God keep me in Egypt. And there were Jews that always wanted to go back. Why did they want to go back? What was it, going back to work hard? No, they didn't want the yoke and the restrictiveness of Judaism. They'd rather work hard and free to do what they want than accept God and be restricted and can't do what they want. So they kept always wanting to go back. What did they tell Moshe for 40 years? We want to go back. I remember the fish, the sushi we had in Egypt, and the watermelons. This is what it says in the Torah. Watermelons. What kind of watermelons do you have in Egypt? Whatever they... What's the point? God took them out of Egypt. He didn't say, I'm taking you out to be free. He didn't say that. I'm taking you out from slavery of power, but now you have to accept mine. And the Jews were like, uh-oh, this is some something. So is it freedom or not? Here we're saying it is. So I'll tell you an interesting thing. And I want to give you an example. Let me just give you... Okay. What is the picture there? Okay. Let's take vegetation. You ready for this? And then you'll get to understand freedom in a true sense. Vegetables. I have in my backyard, I planted tomatoes and onions. In order for the tomatoes to be able to grow and be good tomatoes, they need three things. They need soil, they need water, right? And they need oxygen and some sunlight, okay? Imagine the tomato says, I'm just telling you, just as an imaginary thing, the tomato says, can I be free? Take me out of the soil and let me just fly in the air. I want to be free. I'm so restrictive in the soil that I have to stay in one place. What's wrong with that tomato? Because the tomato doesn't say that for one reason. It knows that if it goes out of the soil, it's not a tomato. It's nothing. So being in the soil and with the water and with the sunlight in one space, that is the best way for the tomato to be the best tomato it could be. For tomatoes. Now let's go to animals. Okay? Let's take animals that are not owned by people. Just like the deers that walk around. The deers, let's take the deers. You tell a deer, I give you a choice. Go to a deer and you say, listen deer, my dear deer, I have a choice for you. I'll give you all the food you need. Ready, whatever they eat, grass, vegetables, I'll give it all ready. But you have to stay in one place. You can't move. Stay right here, in this place. I'll bring you everything you need. You don't have to go look for it anymore. What would it, or you're a free bird, you have to find your own food. What would the deer want?
Free.
Why? Because the animal, in order for the animal to be the best animal it could be, you know, for an animal, is to be able to run, to go where, you know, all over, look for food, you know. It's part of what the animal is. To be restrictive like a tomato, even if you're going to give it all its food, is just the opposite of what the animal is. For a tomato, restrictiveness is the best thing. Because if it moves out of its place, it's not going to grow. It's going to die. But for an animal, it has to move around. Now let's go one more step. Let's go to human beings. Let's not get to Jewish human. Well, let's take human beings. What's the gift that a human has that animals don't have? Every human is intellect. Your sechel. So for a person to truly be a happy, free person is if they could use their intellect to their maximum. They could use their sechel. But if instead they say, you know what, I want to be like an animal. What's an animal? I eat, I drink, and I party, and I do what I want. And never use my special uniqueness that I have, which is the intellect, I don't use that. I live an animal, that's not freedom. That's the opposite of the core of what a human being is. The greatness of a human being is that they have an intellect and a power that they could use their mind and use it in a beautiful way. Yes, they need to eat and drink to survive. But they're not, if they choose to be like the animal, which is all about eating and drinking and not using their intellect, that's the most restrictive slavery there is. It's like being a vegetable. Now, what's a Jewish human being? A Jewish human being has a godly soul. A uniquely godly soul. So, in order for Jew to truly be free is to live the core essence of what they could be. What is their core essence? Torah mitzvahs. That's who they are. So in other words, when a Jew is not living Torah mitzvahs, they're missing the piece of their essence. They're missing the piece of their core, so they're not truly free. Freedom means I can be my true essence, who I am. A tomato, it's a tomato. An animal is an animal. A human being is a... And a Jew is Torah mitzvahs. So freedom, what does freedom mean? It's not about choosing what I want. Not about getting rid of negative employees or employers, whatever. Freedom means that I can be my core essence, who I am, and be my maximum of my core and of my essence. That's freedom. So if someone is sitting in Siberia, in prison, and they're living like a Jew, every morning they daven in prison, they put on their tefillin, they make sure they eat only kosher, they're so freedom, they're the happiest they can be, because they're living who they are in that space. And then you can be a person that's living free in America, and they're so enslaved, because they're not living who their core essence is. You getting me a little or no? You understand what freedom really is or no? So look at what he says in text 6. Text 6, yeah?
Service of God is not something that stifles the identity of the Jew. God forbid. On the contrary, divine service is at the very core of every Jewish being. This is the meaning of the sage's teaching that no person is free except for those who occupy themselves with Torah, even though Torah observance is termed service. Observing Torah and mitzvot is the true nature of a Jew. As the Mishnah teaches, I was created to serve my Creator. Only when serving God is a Jew truly free.
So that makes you true freedom. When you could be your true self. I'll give you just one example. When you go and meet and you want to marry someone, one of the interesting tests to know if this is like someone you could live with, one of the interesting thing is if to say, I can be my true self. I don't have to make like a show. I could just be me. Then I know that whoever the spouse is the right one. I don't have to fake it. I can be me. I can be my true me. That's true freedom. You don't want marriage to be that I'm enslaved, that I can't be me. Then your whole marriage is an enslavement. It's not a freedom. Freedom means I can be who I am. What are you? You're a Jew. So what's your true freedom? To live the Torah and mitzvahs. That's who you are. You're not a vegetable. Yeah, a vegetable has to be in the ground. You're not an animal. An animal has to eat and run around and have a party every day. You're a Jewish human being, so that's your core. That's who you are. So if I can live who I am, that's my freedom. Because that's my whole being. So if I could be that being that I really am, that's freedom. So you could be anywhere, and that does the same thing if you live like that. In text 7, look what he says, text 7.
Slavery is an unnatural state. The natural order of the universe is that animals are under the dominion of humans. But it is against the natural order for a human to be enslaved to another human.
When God created the world, look what he told Adam. He said to Adam, listen, Adam. You see all those animals there? The monkeys, the cows, you know, the animals. You're in charge of them. You rule them. Guide them where to go. Tell them where to turn right, where to turn left. That's your job. But the human being, to be under another human being, is not just... It's not just I'm not working for you. That's not the point. That's not who you are. You're not a servant to another human. You're here to serve your creator. The animal is here to serve the human. But the human is here to serve the creator. So what's your freedom? It's to be who you really are. Who are you? A Jewish being. And therefore, when you learn Torah and do mitzvahs, that's, I could be who I am. So if this is who I am, I'm the happiest person. Now let's go to the case study of paying back a loan. Case study 8 on page 112. Say.
Reuben borrowed money from Shimon and failed to repay the loan. Reuben is now living with a relative where he eats good food and dons expensive clothing. His wife is similarly expensively attired and even provides gifts to her friends. Reuben claims that all of this is provided by his relative, whereas he personally is penniless. He sits idle and refuses to engage in any labor or business of the type he always performed in the past, because he knows that any money he earns will necessarily go toward repaying his loan.
You hear what he did? He borrowed $100,000 from Reuven, borrowed $100,000 from Shimon. Okay, I'm just reading, I'm going to read, it's a true story, it's a text. So he owes Shimon $100,000. The problem is that Reuven knew that if he has the money, he has to pay him back. So what did he do? He gave all his money to his relatives. He says, I don't own anything. He moved into the relative's house. And now Shimon takes him to the Jewish Beis Din and says, listen, I know we're not going to make him put him in jail for it, but I do expect the Jewish court to make him go to work and earn a living so he can pay me back. Force him to go to work. And I'll deduct every paycheck a certain amount to pay back my loan. Can we enforce in the Jewish Beis Din that this guy should not sit and party in his relative's house and his wife buying dresses all day? Let them have to go to work and pay back the loan. You understand the point? Okay, that was case A. Now case B. It's on page 114.
Mr. Britton signed a contract to work for Mr. Turner for 1 year, for which he would be paid $120 in total, equaling $10 per month. But Britton ceased working after 9 months, and Turner was only able to find a replacement worker for the remaining 3 months for $45, equaling $15 per month. Turner did not pay Britton anything for his uncompleted contract, and Britton sued to collect pay for the work he performed.
Get it? What happened? I hired someone to work for me for a year, and I pay him $10 a month, so $120 a year. It was a contract. And after 9 months, he quits. What's the issue? Two issues. One is, for me, for the next 3 months to find workers, I have to pay $15 a month. So that means, with this worker, I only, it's going to cost me another 3 months, $30. With the new workers, it's going to cost me $45. So the question is, this is a serious question that happens a lot in today's time. The question is, number one, do I have to pay the worker to begin with? He quit the middle of the contract. I could tell him, you quit, you get zero. Number two, if you tell me I do have to pay him, can I minus the extra $15 that's going to cost me to hire someone for the last 3 months, take it off of your $90, so I'm only going to pay you $75. You get what I just said? Because you quitting after 9 months caused me to hire someone else that's going to cost me another $15. So do I take it off? Or do you say, listen, thank you, here's your $90, and I just have to pay the extra $15. What would you say?
If you're happy with him, you pay him the full amount, and that's it.
You don't minus anything. And the fact that he leaves in the middle of his contract?
Is his issues?
He has a choice.
And he's a
what does the United States say anything about this?
These are both pretty easy cases in New York and New Jersey. Starting with the second one, the relevant principle here is that New York and New Jersey, like most states, only allow very limited wage deductions. If it's not a deduction from wages that's explicitly authorized by the legislature, you can't make it. So, for example, if your worker does something stupid and destroys equipment, you can't deduct that from his paycheck. You could fire him because he's incompetent, but you still have to pay him for the work that he performed. The exceptions to that rule generally have to do with when the deduction is for the benefit of the worker. So, for example, with the worker's consent, you can deduct from his wages to contribute to a 401k plan or to pay a premium for health insurance, things like that. But you certainly cannot deduct from somebody's wages because they quit in the middle of a contract. And the fact that you had to hire somebody for more money to replace them, that's the employer's problem. They can't deduct it. The employer here would still have to pay the worker for the first 9 months, regardless of the fact that he quit.
So even though he has a contract for 12?
Yeah, well, because we don't have, we don't have involuntary servitude in the U.S. A court, generally speaking, won't force somebody to work, even if they breach the contract by not working. And you can't deduct it from his wages either. As far as the first case, this is a problem that comes up a lot in post-judgment enforcement. I mean, we don't have debtor's prison in America. If you get a monetary judgment, you have to have a way to enforce it against the debtor. And the ways that you do that are either you garnish a percentage of their wages, which is limited. It's usually 10 or 15% of each paycheck at the most. Or if they have liquid assets like money in the bank account, you can freeze the bank account and get a court order turning the money over to you. Or if they have hard assets like a car, other valuable personal property, then you can have the sheriff seize them. But you can't force somebody to work. So if a debtor wants to sit on his hands and do nothing to spite you because he doesn't want to work because you would get a percentage of it, unfortunately, there's nothing you can do to force him to work. The only remedy would be the gifts that the wife is giving away. Those are under New Jersey law, those are fraudulent transfers. That is, when there's having a debt that you can't pay, you can't just give away things without getting reasonably equivalent value. So assuming the wife and the husband have shared assets, they have the same bank account, they pool their monies, her giving away these expensive gifts would be fraudulent transfers, and the court would seize them and give them back to the creditor. But other than that, the creditor's out of luck, unless the guy chooses to go to work, and that's up to him.
So he has a very strong point, and we're just going to, for 1 minute, there used to be a concept of going to jail. I don't know if you know about this. It was called debtor's prison, it was called?
Yeah.
You know about this?
Yeah.
In the United States, in England, all over, that if you didn't pay back money you owed, you went to jail. And you were there either for two choices. Either you paid back somehow, a relative or someone helped you. And in these jails, the family members, your family could come join you. They're not in jail, the family members, but you could have your family come and spend time and go home and come. They're free to leave. You just can't leave. The interesting thing about these jails is that after it became a big problem because in some...
No space for them.
Not only no space for them. No, but also they didn't treat them, they didn't give them the necessities. 25% of them died in the jail. They didn't give them any rights, nothing. It was disgusting. Rats, mice, lice, fleas. It was, you didn't want to be there. But the interesting thing is that in Europe, in the up till maybe 150 years ago, they used to take, if you owned a property tax, let's say, a tax for the town, They used to take the family and put them in a dungeon. The Jews used to get together, and that was called Pidyon Shvuyim. They used to actually go collect money from all over Europe to go help, because what happened? The families didn't have enough money to pay for the lease or the rent, whatever it was. So they used to pay them and get hundreds of families out of these dungeons. But what's a dungeon? A hole in the ground, and you get just a thing of water and a loaf of bread. Just think what it was. So the point here is like this. According to Torah, if you owe someone money, what could I do to get you? There is, by the way, David, isn't this a thing about a husband that's divorced, they have to give alimony and child support?
Right.
And let's say they don't. Is there anything that sometimes he could be in prison?
Generally speaking, you can't throw them in prison for that. There are other things you can do, a lot of which are counterproductive. Like, for example, if they have a professional license, you can suspend that. But of course, if you suspend their license, then they're definitely not going to make any money. Or you can take away their driver's license, but then they can't drive to work, so they're definitely not going to make any money and pay it in alimony. Generally speaking, in the U.S., we don't throw people in jail, even if they haven't paid child support or alimony that they're required to pay.
Interesting. Okay. So they don't do it, yeah? Okay. So let's read text 8 about loans. Go. Scripture.
Okay. Scripture establishes that when creditors demand payment of debts and the debtor's own assets, the debtor's existential needs must first be provided for, following which the remainder of the debtor's assets are granted to the creditors. If the debtors own no assets, or if their assets are only sufficient to provide for their existential needs, then nothing can be done to the debtors, and they may not be imprisoned.
Okay, so there's nothing to do. Now, text 9.
Shimon's request that Reuben work in order to repay his debt is not something that the court can compel. The court cannot extend his jurisdiction over Reuben's actual person by compelling him to perform work in order to repay his debt.
Okay, so in Jewish court, you owe money. I can't do anything about it. I could I scream at you, I could yell at you, but there's nothing, I can't hurt you. I could take all your assets, I could. Any money you have, any property, it's all under the loan, 100%. But to you personally and to your family, I can't do anything. I can't put you in jail, I can't do anything. However, in America, there is a law, a very interesting law, that when someone is in prison for a crime they did, let's say whatever crime they did, they're sitting in prison, the prison has a right to make the prisoner work, and they don't have to pay them, they don't have to, they could force labor them, meaning they can't say, well, I'm in prison, leave me alone. No.
In the army also?
Okay, but I'm saying in a prison, you have to work. It's not like a choice, well, if I want to, I don't want to. No, you have to read text 10, prison labor.
Once cleared by the prison doctor, inmates can be forced to work under threat of punishment as severe as solitary confinement. Legally, this labor may be totally uncompensated. More typically, inmates are paid meagerly, as little as 2 cents per hour, for their full-time work in the fields, manufacturing, warehouses, or kitchens. How is this legal? Didn't the 13th Amendment abolish all forms of slavery and involuntary servitude in this country? Not quite. In the shining promise of freedom that was the 13th Amendment, a sharp exception was carved out. Section 1 of the amendment provides, neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as punishment for crime whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States or any place subject to their jurisdiction. Simply put, our incarcerated people have no constitutional rights in this arena. They can be forced to work as punishment for their crimes.
In Jewish law, we can't. So even if someone does a crime and we punish them for the crime, but that doesn't give us the right that we can make them work just because they did a crime. We can make them pay for the crime, or whatever the crime is, they got to fix, whatever, you know, whatever it was. But to say, since you did a crime and now you're in prison, therefore I could use your work and make you work hard, and if not, you could have confinement and all that, in Jewish, it doesn't exist. Why? Because, again, a Jewish law wants you to be a free person. A free person means that you could be your full who you are. The only way you could be your full core who you are is to be a Jew that could be a Jew. Interesting enough that in Jewish law there's no such a thing as prison as a penalty. So if someone, let's say, does a criminal act, we're going to give you a consequence, whether it's 39 lashes, whether you have to pay back double, whether whatever the consequence is, good. But to say to you, sit in jail, lock you up, and work, there's no such a thing, because it's not giving the person to be able to be freedom of to be who he is.
Even for crimes?
We give him the punishment for the crime, but there's no jail for the crime. There's a punishment. Unless the only time we put someone in jail is in two cases. One is which we're putting him on trial, so we have to know. We don't want him to run away. We keep him, but we make the trial right away. We don't let him sit 5 years for the trial. Number two, if he's a danger to society. So if someone is a person that's dangerous to society, then there's another problem. That if he's going to be free, he's going to hurt everyone. So that's another issue. We want him to be away. But in jail, we can't force him to work now. We want him to be free who he is, to be a Jew. Interesting that the Rebbe instituted in all the prisons in the United States, it's called the Aleph Institute. You know what the Aleph Institute is? That every Jew in the United States prison has a right to be a full Jew. So kosher food, lighting the menorah. In many jails they have minyans and they have a Torah and they have a whole service, everything. Because to be freedom means to be able to be who you are. And who are you? You're a Jew. However, I know someone here that's in jail in the right here in Bergen County. I forgot the name of the jail here. So anyway, so he wants kosher food. So the jail allows you to do it on one condition. That it has to be that the community is paying for the kosher food. Interesting. So the rabbi, that's the rabbi of the jail, he's officially a chaplain in the jail, and he gets paid by the government to be a chaplain. He could get kosher food to the person if the community collects the money for this food. And the rabbi has to prove that this guy is kosher because he's Jewish, not because he just likes the food, it's better. Because most people would want kosher food, because it's not the jail food, it's the food you get from Madan or from Chayes Tina Galat, whatever. So the rabbi has to come and says, okay, this guy is Jewish, he has a right, and then once he signs it, then he has a right to be. Okay, so the reason I'm saying this is because in Judaism, even if a person has to sit in jail, he can't make him work, because then he's a slave to a slave, and you need to be a slave to God to truly be you. And the only way you could be you is to do what God wants. So that's out. However, we're going to just read quickly text 11, how it was in the United States and in England and in Europe before they got rid of all the debt jails. What was it?
The debtors were sent to jail until they were able to pay off their debts. These were called debtors' prisons, a peculiar form of punishment. Indefinite incarceration was the mode of punishment. Sometimes the convicts stayed with their families in the prison. Family members were free to come and go according to their wish. Therefore, even children were born and raised there. The prisons were full of rats, lice, and fleas. The prisoners were denied basic necessities of life, such as food, water, and clothing. It is said that these places were so dirty and filthy that around 25% of the inmates died due to these horrible living conditions. The debtors were imprisoned and tortured at the pleasure of the creditors. When other countries of Europe had legislation limiting the debt imprisonment term to 1 year, England did not have such a law. When in 1842 the Fleet Prison was closed, it was found that debtors were there for more than 30 years.
Now, Torah is given 3,334 years ago. We are already ahead of our times. From today, we don't do it anymore. But then the Torah was already forbidden 3,334. Nothing. Now, what happened? So in text 12, an interesting story happened. There were two Jews that one lend money, borrowed money from another. And in the contract, the Jew wrote in the contract to the other Jew that he would live in this in the country Oregon. Is this such a caution? No, in a country in Oregon. Near Spain.
Aragon.
Is this such a thing?
Yes. It's the old Spain.
The old Spain. He lived there, and what happened was he wrote in the contract that he wrote like he obligated himself that whatever the country's law about debt is, he accepts. Means he accepts to follow Aragon country law, even though he's a Jew to a Jew. What happened at the end? He didn't have the money to pay back. So the Jew was said, listen, I understand, I'm not going to put him to jail. You know, I can't, but I want him to, you know, work hard and work, we call it work off your money. You know, like, I'll take him to work for me and I'll deduct. You know, like, he'll work for me for 10 months and he'll deduct. So look what happened. He asked this question to the Ridvaz and he gave him the answer. Say, text 12. Reuven.
You want me to read the whole thing? Reuven borrowed money from Shimon. In the contract, Reuven put up his personal freedom as collateral. For so is the law in Aragon. If a debtor does not own vehicle assets from which his debt can be repaid, he is incarcerated. Shimon the creditor now demands the repayment of his loan, but Reuven has no assets from which to pay. Shimon requests that Reuven be imprisoned as he explicitly agreed to in advance. Reuven argues that he cannot be imprisoned for his debt because there is no precedent in Jewish law for a person to be imprisoned due to a debt. You requested my opinion on the law in such a case. Response: Jewish law sides with Reuven the debtor. A person cannot consent to be incarcerated. The Torah states the children of Israel belong to me as servants, from which we derive that they cannot be made servants to other servants. No contract clause can allow for a person to be compelled to work, not even in his regular vocation. It goes without saying that no clause can allow for a person to be incarcerated and made to land in a dark dungeon.
So the same thing this lady Betty that says she wants to be a servant and she wants to go work for, it doesn't work. You could make any condition, you cannot be a slave to a slave. You belong to God, and your freedom is to do what God wants. That's going to make you who you are. So being servants to God is bringing out who you are, and that you can't give up. Now let's go and finish with employment, employer. An interesting law in Torah that if you hire a worker for a day, and you say to him, I'm paying you for the day $100, and your job is to take all the bricks from here and take it to across the street where you're doing construction. And after half a day, the guy says, I'm quitting, I can't, it's not for me. How do you treat it? Look what the Torah says, you know? This is 3,000 years ago, yeah?
A worker has the right to withdraw from their employment even in the middle of the working day. This right emerges from the verse, the children of Israel belong to me as servants, whereby God is stating they are my servants, not servants to other servants.
However, how much are you paying him? Because you pay per hour. Now we have to pay per minute, so I mean, because who knows? They might leave in a half hour, you know. But here the question remained. In this instance, he had to find another worker to finish because he had to take the bricks, let's say, to the construction site, and he couldn't find someone for the same, so he had to pay extra. So his question was, does he deduct it from the worker that left the middle so he could pay the guy to finish the job? So read what he says in text 14.
an employee has the right to quit their job even in the middle of the day, and they are given the upper hand when calculating the pay they are entitled to receive.
That means the employee gets the upper hand, which means?
The quitting employee is entitled to payment for the value of work accomplished before quitting. This remains true even if the market rate for such work has since risen, leaving the employer unable to hire another worker to complete the job with the remainder of the funds. For example, an employee was hired for 18 hours per day, but quit halfway through the first day. Even if the cost of this particular form of labor has now risen to 12 dinars per day, so that a replacement worker for the second half of the day will charge 6 dinars, the quitting employee must still be paid 4 dinars for the half-day work.
Clear? However, there is one way, and in one instance, that the employee does lose, and his hand, as we call it, on the lower end. How? If I hire you to do something that it has to be finished, or else the product is going to waste. He gives an example. In those times, they used to have flax. It's like a
linen.
Linen that they used to put in water to soak, and it's like a process to make it that you could use it for material. And it has to be done time sensitive. In other words, you can't just quit and then he has to find employees a day later, because then it ruins the whole thing. So if it's an irreversible loss, then you could minus what it costs you to hire the extra worker. Because you left me with a predicament, because you know I have to finish this. You see, if I hire you to do construction and you stop, so you could tell me, okay, don't do construction. That's it, what's going to happen? But if I'm hiring you to do something that is time sensitive and you stop in the middle of the job, so then I'm compelled that I have to get this job done, so I'm going to pay anyone more money. So you're putting me in a position that I can't even have a choice to try to get wages, people to work the same wage as you, because I have to finish it today. So you made me pay more that I could minus from you. You following me? So say text 15.
If the work was time sensitive and the work will cause irreversible damage, the quitting employee has the lower hand in the calculation of wages. For example, workers hired to remove flax from the water it was soaking in. If the flax is not punctually removed from the water, it will decay. If there are extenuating circumstances, such as illness or the death of a family member, the employee has the right to quit while retaining the upper hand in the calculation of their wages. Absent such circumstances, the employee is given the lower hand when calculating their pay, because quitting prematurely may cause the employer an irreversible loss.
Does that hold true in the United States?
Not if it's an employee, no. Like I said, you can't, there's very few things that you can deduct from an employee's wages. The fact that they cause the employer a loss is not a basis for a deduction.
Even if the product is getting lost.
Yeah, even if the employer suffers some financial loss. Now, if the worker is an independent contractor, the rules are different. Independent contractors don't have as many protections, and you could have a liquidated damages clause in the contract, for example, that says, you know, if you don't complete this job within X number of hours, then such and such amount is deducted from the total compensation. But that would only be for independent contractors.
Well, that's what he says in text 16.
Yeah.
Do you see this text 16? He says, say, the law?
The law granting an employee the right to quit does not extend to independent contractors. An employee is protected by the principle implied in the verse, they are my servants, not servants to other servants. But this does not apply to independent contractors, for the contractors serve only themselves.
Right, because the independent contractor is working for themselves, not working for you.
Yeah.
So then if they quit, it's a whole different story. Okay, so an employee, the Torah gives rights. So what is the message to us? If you go to case A and B, case A was, the story was with the...
Betty?
No, the Betty we already said she the loan,
yeah,
that he owed money, Riven and Shimon, he borrowed money and he wanted him to go to, he wrote in the contract that he accepts the Oregon law, and they said you can't basically Basically, there's nothing you could do to get the person to pay physically. You can't hurt him. You can take his assets. He has to pay. It's a wicked. The Torah says you're wicked if you don't pay back the loan. Everything is true. But to go do something physically to him, there's nothing you can do. And then the second one, which is an employee could quit in the middle of the job. And if he doesn't cause a loss, if he does cause a loss, then you could minus the difference that it is to hire another employee versus the employee that did. So the Rabbi Yehuda Levi says, what's the lesson we learn for us? It's called servant of time. You ever heard of such a thing, servant of time? That instead of being servant to God, we're so busy with non-essential things that we don't have time for the essential things. For the real freedom. So, can you come to study for an hour? I don't have time. Can you come to that? I don't have time. Can you? It's a beautiful thing. Rabbi Yehuda Levi wrote this. Servant?
Servants of time are servants of servants. A servant of God alone is free. Therefore, when each person seeks their portion, my portion is God, says my soul free.
So if a person always is with the excuse, there's no time because they're occupied with non-essential things, they're not free. They're enslaved because they're working for something that's not who they are. And they're enslaved to it and they can't free themselves from it, so they're the biggest slave. Interesting. So if a person doesn't have time for who they are and to be truly free, they're really in slavery. So how many people today are free? Very little. That a person could choose and say, I am choosing to do what I want to do and be who I am and be, no, that's a commitment. But then you're really free. Because then you're who you are. You're not a tomato. You're not an animal. You're a Jew. And that's very important. I just end up with a little story. There was once a true story. They were sitting and they had a debate between a Jew. What's the difference anyway? So the Rebbe called a non-Jewish worker that worked in the house. Like we have here, Lou. You know, okay. So he called him. He asked him, I want to ask you a question. Do you come to work every day? Of course I come to work every day. Do you come on time? Of course I come on time. I'm very devoted. So he says, why are you working? He says, why am I working? I want to earn some money. Why are you earning money? He says, I want to have food, and I can have a bottle of drink, like a liquor, like they used to love in Russia, they love vodka. I can have my bottle of vodka. And why do you need a bottle of vodka? What do you mean, what I need a bottle of vodka? That's what I'm here for, to have another bottle of vodka. And then what do you do after you have a bottle of vodka? I go to sleep. And then what do you do after you go to sleep? I get up and I can work, so I can earn money, so I can have another bottle of vodka. And then when I have another bottle of vodka, I can go to sleep, and then I can work, and that's the whole life. So then he calls the Jewish worker in the house. I think his name was Yankel, I don't remember. He says, Yankel, do you come to work? Of course. Are you there on time? Yeah, of course. Why do you work? He says, to earn a living. Why do you earn a living? So I could serve Hashem. Why do you want to serve Hashem? Because that's who I am. And what do you do when you have some money? I do what Hashem wants me to do. So he was just bringing out that there's people working and working, eating and eating. But this eating and working is all enslavement, and this eating and eating is all the purpose of who I am. L'chaim, l'chaim. Let's be true free people. Be who you are. Don't be who you're not. L'chaim. Okay, thank you.